Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smalders. With me is Laurie Harrison, and she will introduce today's guest.
And our guest today is Tom Cowan, who has lived on Lopez since the 1970s. He has had an interesting life here, raising his children, he and his wife Tammy, working in a variety of situations and jobs, and especially, too, as a part of the political history of Lopez Island. So, Tom, we welcome you, and I guess I'd like to ask you what brought you originally to Lopez Island.
Well, thanks for inviting me to this program. I'm honored that you're doing that. What brought me to the island was in the early 1960s, I was in high school and had a good friend whose parents owned a house. Actually, it's the house that Cam and Bobby DeFore have. And we came up from time to time visiting and enjoyed it a lot. And I can't remember how many times we came up in those days, but it was a lot of fun, to the point that in 1964, a bunch of us guys, there were about five of us, that had all just graduated from high school, decided to spend our summer on Lopez Island before going off to college, and we did that. And we worked in the hay fields and did odd jobs all summer long, and had a great time. It was a wonderful transition from high school to summer to college, to be able to enjoy that. We got to meet a lot of the people then. That's when I met Larry Cochran and Dolores Foss and other people. I remember Joe Fox, who's been gone many years, late night evenings, him teaching me new guitar licks, and enjoyed that a lot. And that was the start. So we always had this strong affinity for Lopez Island.
I'm imagining it was quite a time for a bunch of high school boys to come up and be on the island in the 60s.
Yeah, I can't tell all those stories, but I can say that it was a good summer. We had a lot of fun, and I think the locals were just as happy to see us leave when summer was over. In fact, I can assure you of that.
That was a time before they had all these special shaped hay. I don't even know what you call them, but
the round bales.
Yeah, yeah. The round bales.
No, no. This is the
old
like
fashioned
50 pound bales that. Yeah. That you bucked into the hay wagon and then would stack them in the barn.
Right, right.
Boy, that's good work for brawny high school kids.
It was.
Yeah, suntan time.
Well, I had hay fever actually, so I kind of bundled up.
Oh goodness. Okay, so then what happened? How'd you get here from there? You're in college now?
Well, I went to the University of Washington and ended up actually getting a really good job, which is what I wanted to do, is to work at a stock brokerage office. And I did that for a number of years, and to the point where I was actually being quite successful. I was the youngest vice president of the company ever, and I should have been just as happy as could be, but in fact, I was missing something, and after a lot of thought, realized that perhaps I'd gone a good path, but perhaps not the right path for me. And this was at a time when there was already a movement in the early 70s for a lot of young people to leave the city and move to the country, move to a rural area. And Tammy and I decided to that we wanted to, even though we lived on Queen Anne Hill, which was a wonderful part of Seattle, we had this car got stolen, the house got broken into, the kids' tricycles got stolen, and we decided we didn't like that and decided we wanted to make a move and raise our kids in a rural environment. We moved up here in 1974. Matt was just turned six, and Scott was 3 years old, and of course they went through their entire school here and have become very, very successful in their own lives elsewhere, which was part of the thing too. At that time, you raise your kids here, but there's a big world out there, and you want them to move on, and that was certainly our attitude. So it was a good move.
Great,
what a change from the city to such a rural environment. Was it a good? Did it feel good for you and Tammy to make that transition?
It was easier for me. It took Tammy a little while, but we used to joke about it, is that she wasn't real happy for the first few months. But after a year, you couldn't get her off the island. You literally could not get her to leave the island. So it was a good transition. And I got to tell you, one of the things that sticks out in my mind so much is in those days, and I'll never forget this, is that when we were brand new to the island, of course, the islanders, they're all buzzing around talking about the newcomers. But what was really nice is you'd go to the grocery store, which is still was then and is still the hub, and people would walk up to you and introduce themselves and say, I hear that you're the new people that bought the old Gorham place, and I'm so-and-so, you know, and I'm happy to meet you. And that happened all the time. And what a wonderful introduction to a place, because we didn't know a lot of the people. We had some friends here. It's one of the reasons we moved, is I had a couple of good friends that already lived here. But that was a wonderful introduction. And I mean, the other thing that was so outstanding is how Romaine and Mary Ritchie really took us, our whole family, under their wing, and taught us a lot about, especially livestock. Fortunately, he was just starting to raise bees, and I was already raising bees, and so I was able to help him a little tiny bit for a few months until he ended up knowing a lot more than I did about it. But in all other aspects, they taught us to the point where we raised all our livestock. We had cattle and pigs and chickens and ducks, of course, bees, and our kids really got into it, became very involved in 4-H to the point where each of them at different times became the overall livestock champion at the county fair. Wow. Through their 4-H. I was a 4-H leader for about 10 years, doing pigs for most of the time and then cattle for the last couple of years. So those were you know, wonderful introductions to the island.
And very courageous to do this when you came from the city and then, you know, being true farmers.
Well, I wouldn't say I was ever a true farmer, but no. We certainly raised livestock and had huge gardens and did the whole thing. You know, we even made soap from hog lard and, you know, different things like that. And we had our own milk cow and
really?
Used the milk to make the cream and the cheese and the whole thing.
Milking.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we did all that.
You milked your own cow?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Vice president from a stockbroker firm.
Yeah.
He's out there.
I wasn't anymore. And we didn't have any money, so it was important to keep the cost low. So,
wow.
So that was, I was still young. We moved up here when I was 26.
Okay.
26, yeah. 26, 27, I can't remember.
Yeah.
So, we've
Great.
Been.
And so, you know, so you're a stockbroker in Seattle. You move up here, what were your expectations as far as employment? And how did those match up with how things actually developed for you, Tom?
Well, not very well. I was, I had some ridiculous notion that I could raise bees during the day and play music on the weekends and have an income to feed my family. Well, that was just a non-starter. It didn't work. And I really had struggled for the first few years. We got along a lot because Tammy actually was one of the founders of, or we both worked at it, but she was a founder of the Lopez Food Co-op that started about, oh, I guess that must have been 1975 or something like that, and which was a great way of getting our food cheap, where one family every couple of weeks would go down to Seattle to make the rounds and come back that afternoon. You'd distribute it. There were about 15 people. I understand that still may be going on, although we haven't been members in many, many years, but that's wonderful if it is, because it was a great idea. We got along, a lot of people did a lot of bartering. That was a very, very popular way of surviving. And I can tell you a couple of things about that is that, Phil Hastings did most of our butchering for us, and we made a deal where he butchered several pigs, that I think three or four that I did at one time, and a steer. And in return, I wired his barn and his butcher shop, which was in desperate need of wiring. And so we traded that way, and it was great for both of us. He It was he did what he was good at. I did what I was good at. That was in the late 70s. And earlier on, right when we first moved here, I think in 74, Stephen Rubleski was a potter, but had no electricity where he lived. And so we made a deal where we set up his kiln out in one of our sheds and got it wired so it would work for his kiln. And in return, he threw us a very, very nice set of dinner dishes, which is interesting. Here we are some 36 years later, and we still use those as our daily dishes. So that was and there was bartering all the time. I would do wiring in later years for firewood, and that was a lot of that. But the jobs were hard. My first job here was actually, I was a hod carrier for Jerry Frisch. But as you said, Ollie, I'm, what's a city boy doing with this? I wasn't particularly strong or in that good a shape in those days, and I couldn't do it. It was physically way too difficult, mixing the mortar, carrying it up ladders and scaffolds and giving it to Jerry and going back down, doing that all day. So we made a deal where I would work one day, and Richard Ward would do the next day, and we'd alternate days, and we could do it.
So you could recover again.
So we could recover. So the two of us traded off and did one job, but that was a difficult job. But you did what you could do to get along, and it was all part of the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. One of the things we did was to you could always go out and catch some bottom fish, some rock fish, or cod, ling cod. And usually in an hour you could get enough to have a couple of dinners. Mm-hmm. And so we'd do that. And
you had a boat then?
No, but I had friends that had a boat at that point. I didn't have a boat, but you'd usually get a couple of guys to go out and trade around.
Uh-huh. And you weren't sport fishing then. You were fishing for dinner.
That's right. Yeah. I didn't seem to have enough time to sport fish, except at Hummel Lake. I've always fly fished at Hummel Lake, so that always found time for that.
Where did you guys like to fish?
For the rockfish?
Yeah.
Well, we'd usually just go not that far out of Fisherman Bay. There was a spot over by Shaw Island, but we rarely went not even halfway to Friday Harbor. That was typically the close. That's why I say you could go out for an hour and catch enough and you only had usually an hour because you had to fish it at slack tide anyway.
Oh, okay.
So you'd go out for an hour. You usually got enough for a couple of meals, and that was the way it was back then.
And crab?
And crab were plentiful, and they're still plentiful to this day. But back then, one of the things we did, partly because I didn't have a boat, so I couldn't go crabbing myself, but you couldn't pass up the deal. Many people on the island, during the crab season, you just go down to the Bumblebee dock down in Barlow Bay, which is now the Salmon Point dock, and there would be a coffee can there. You'd throw in a dollar and take a live crab out of the big buckets that were there. And to my knowledge, nobody ever stole anything. It seemed to work well. It was all for locals anyway, but that was quite a deal. So we'd do that whenever we wanted some crab.
I remember when I got here in 95, of course, this was, 20 years after you're talking about, but I remembered being awed by the fact that we could ride our bikes to the south end, and there was a cornfield down there and a coffee can. And you could go into the cornfield, take out a couple of, ears of corn, and leave whatever you wanted in the coffee can.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the early 90s, and that just, being a city person, I was just so thrilled with that level of trust and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and from what you're saying, obviously it was a tradition on this island.
Yes, that's the way you got eggs and,
yep.
I still get my flowers that way. Yeah. Yeah, I still do. Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, we, the kids would get a little, of course, we lived right there on Fisherman Bay Road, and so, which was a story too. In 1974, we bought that 5 acres in a pretty rundown house. I had to do a bunch of renovating. But
okay, hold on. I'm going to stop you and ask you to describe where you were for people who are listening to this.
Our house that we bought was on right at the intersection of Fisherman Bay Road and Airport Road.
Okay.
And we bought that in 1974 for $14,000 for the house and 5 acres and a bunch of outbuildings, which we used which we use for livestock and that sort of thing. It used to be one of the largest farms on the island, but it had been cut down over the years to be 5 acres. Did it on a handshake, basically, where the seller, which was Bill and Elaine Hughes, said, how much money do you want to put down? Well, $1,500. Okay. And how much do you want to pay a month? We said, we can only afford $100. Okay. And that was the deal. They asked us. And that whatever we said was okay with them. Of course, they had their calculator and stuff and said, well, you're going to owe it for this many years, you know. But it was kind of a wonderful way of again, an introduction to the island. I mean, you don't see that very, very many places. But it was a different time, too.
Right. Wow. Handshake. Okay, but you were starting to tell a story about your property when I interrupted you. Was that the story?
I think that was the story,
yeah. The house is still there.
The house is still there. We sold it 10 years ago, and now live. We've got a really nice place on Center Road.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but that's where you raised the boys.
Yeah, they raised the boys. They understood. They weren't any too happy about a selling house, but they understood.
Yeah. I remember I wasn't happy about it. Wow, they sold it.
It was a big deal after being there 26 years.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. So you were working as a hod worker. And then what happened next?
Well, that didn't work out for very long. I ended up going to work for Dean Pricer, who's electrical contractor, and I had just worked for him for a short time, just got my apprentice card, and my good friend Tim Stidham was just getting his journeyman card, but he'd only worked for him for, I think, a year and a half.
Okay.
And Dean up and moved to Texas. like with not much notice, and so we were kind of stuck, but we really liked this was finally a real job where we could do, and in fact it was something that I really had always wanted to do. When I'd been in Seattle, I always worked with my head, and I always wanted something that I could work with my hands. I always thought that would be something that I would regret if I never did that in my life. Maybe not all my life, but at some point being able to work with some kind of a craft or whatever that I could do with my hands. And so I really liked this electrical work. But we were stuck. And we took the big chance, Tim and I, and formed Lopez Island Electric. And formed our own company, even though I was absolute novice and Tim wasn't that much more. and it was a struggle to begin with, but we actually, a kind of a funny story, that we almost immediately started getting some business, because there was a really good electrician on the island. His name was Moki Kawani, and he was a very good electrician, but he was kind of notorious of not finishing his jobs. And pretty much after Tim and I went into business and advertised, we started getting these calls saying, you know, I've got a job that's half done. I haven't seen Moki in 3 months, or I haven't seen Moki in 6 months, and would you come over and finish it? Well, it was great for us because we were able to go in and get some work pretty immediately, and that was important. But it was a struggle for a number of years, but ultimately we ended up being very successful at that and ended up selling that business to Rick Gehring, who's since sold it again.
And how many years were you Lopez Island Electric?
Well, I would say that was for 8 years, I think from 75, well, actually, 7 or 8 years. I was elected county commissioner when I was 1982, and that's when I turned it over to Tim, and Tim shortly after that sold it to Rick.
Okay.
A couple years later.
And of course it's still going great guns
today.
Yeah,
yeah, it's nice, but a lot of people didn't know that Tim and I started that business. So that was kind of the work. This was at a time we're still in the mid 60s, and both my parents, mom and dad, moved up. In just several years after us, 3 or 4 years after us, they came up and visited and really liked it. And
in the 70s.
Yeah, this is like 77, I think, when they moved up. And
your mom and dad being?
Doug and Millie Cowan.
There we go.
Yeah.
All right.
And
where did they come from?
Well, they'd moved around a bit, which is they'd most recently lived in San Francisco. We all grew up in Seattle. But he'd been transferred a couple of times and was getting kind of tired of that, and really liked this, and decided that this would be an excellent move for them to come up, and it was in all manners was excellent. It was wonderful for us to have them close. It was wonderful for our children to be close to their grandparents. It was just an absolutely great experience. Mom, of course, has been gone for over 3 years now, but you can still see Dad driving around. He's got this all-electric gem car that he drives around. So if you see him driving around in the village from time to time, and he's still on his own here, doing well.
And so lots of people know your folks because Millie, along with your wife Tammy, got started with the Enchanted Needle, and then your dad was in insurance, and this was in an area of Lopez called Old Town. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's what they called the building down there where the Bay Cafe and the Fudge Factory now is called Old Town, and it was kind of interesting. Mom and Tammy started the Enchanted Needle. And this is a little bit of, I guess the story is a little bit of musical chairs, is that they started on the east side, which is where Rita Elliott now has her jewelry shop, and pretty quickly outgrew that. And about the same time, Jeff Nichols had the Blossom over on the west side and started outgrowing that as well. And in the center was a tavern named the Rub-A-Dub Pub. And that all lasted for a number of years. I can't recall how long. But then the Rub-A-Dub Pub went out of business. And Tammy and Jeff were both kind of crowded. And so the Enchanted Needle switched over into a larger space, which was on the west side, which is where the Bay Cafe is now. And Jeff moved Blossom into the middle, which is now the Fudge Factory. And my dad, who was selling insurance part-time for what ultimately became Islanders Insurance, he was over then in the old Enchanted Needle, which is where Rita is now. So then of course, even after Mom and Tammy sold the Enchanted Needle, there was even more musical chairs being done because, in all honesty, the restaurant should be on the west side and have the nice view, and that's ultimately what happened.
And the post office, the old post office, was across the road.
Then, right.
In what is that little, what's now been remodeled, but was a cement building right there across.
Yeah, a concrete block building that now is Jamie and Lauren Stevens' garage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that was the post office for many years. And I guess this is jumping back, when a little more history on Old Town, when in the early 60s, when we first started coming up here, the what is now the Fudge Factory was where the grocery store was. And
the Lopez Purity Market.
That's right. Old Man Carpenter ran that, and he could talk your ear off, but he was a lot of fun.
And and just as a side note here, the new market, which is going to set to open next month, has a big historical photo in there of the old Lopez Purity Market.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And they have a little history on the back wall of the Carpenter's family ownership of the market down through the years.
Well, that'll be interesting if they've got one of the pictures, because somehow some photographer pulled us all out of that store one time. There's like five people in the store, my friend and I were one of them, and Old Man Carpenter, and came out, took a picture, and made a postcard out of it.
No.
Yeah, we've got a postcard. I'm sure they've got it. Maybe it'll end up being one of the pictures.
On the wall, wouldn't that be a crack?
Yeah.
And you're calling him Old Man Carpenter.
Oh, I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't. But that's how everybody knew him. It was Bill's father.
Bill's father.
Yeah, we are now on the third generation.
What everybody called him.
Yeah. Isn't that grand? Oh my gosh. Well, and before we move along here, I just want to take a moment to honor Millie, your mama. Because she was a very special, special friend of mine. I only got to know Millie a couple of years before she left Lopez Island. And when I knew her, she was struggling with Alzheimer's. And I remember so many people would say to me, gosh, if only you'd known Millie back when. But I was so in love with her in the very present moment. Yeah. Just one of the sweetest, most open-hearted, loving people. And Millie and I spent a lot of time in the village during our years together. And talk about bees. People were like bees to honey to that woman. coming up all the time and loving her up, and she just was always loving him back.
I remember her in the Enchanted Needle, because I was not much of a seamstress, so I always had all kinds of questions, mm-hmm. but she would answer every one of them, you know, mm-hmm. and help me along with whatever it was that I was trying to do. Yeah.
Amazing quilter.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful legacy on this island, Millie.
Yeah, she was very special.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I remember also that little post office when we moved here full-time in 82, we had sent all our books, you know, book rate, to Lopez, and the post office in Modesto said to us, are there no books on Lopez Island? You know, because we were sending all these boxes. And then when they arrived here, we got a frantic call from the postmaster who said, could you please come? Because we cannot move anymore, because there was not enough space for, you know, that many boxes. So,
well, two librarians, for heaven's sake. So let's explore your years in politics. I, for one, would like to hear what were some of the more important issues during that 12-year period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
well, there were many. There were so many, and they came so fast that I've forgotten a lot of them, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, people remind me from time to time, well, remember this, remember that. And I'll honestly struggle to remember some of them, but certainly I remember a few of the ones. When I first went into office, my first day on the job, which was the first day of the budget mm-hmm. year, Cy Stevens had been elected the same time I was elected. He was elected county auditor when I was elected county commissioner. He comes in and informs the county commissioners that we are on interest-bearing warrants, that we are out of money, and interest-bearing warrants mean that the county was broke and had to borrow money from the bank in order to pay salaries and other expenses, which is a terrible thing to be in.
Wow.
The county now, as is in the papers all the time, and it happens from time to time, have real budgetary problems right now because the economy is so poor. They have a very limited reserve, but they do have a reserve. They're not on interest-bearing warrants. We were on interest-bearing warrants, and we had to deal with it. And it was a very difficult time because I was brand new, and unfortunately, the other two commissioners that had got us into that trouble didn't seem to really care. So I worked very hard with a lot of people, and unfortunately, because it worked, but it was an unfortunate situation, as we had to shut the county courthouse down for 2 days a month for a period of time until we could recover the money, and that hurt employees, and it wasn't a popular thing to do, but we had to do it, and we did do it
as a fiscal measure,
and
wow.
You know, so that was a difficult thing that I walked into the first day.
The first day.
And it took within a year, we were back with a very small reserve, and we built up our reserves over the years, and I think we did a very good job in that regard.
So these financial woes, like we're experiencing today, may be a little more cyclical than we imagine.
Well, it's a funny thing. You know, I've seen this for many, many years. People think, oh, we've got the worst problems in the world, and, you know, everything's gone to hell in a handbasket, and there's these problems that have got to get fixed. That's pretty much always the way it is. in local government, especially in a small county like San Juan County, I mean, the rubber hits the road over there at the county courthouse, and these issues, they come and they go, but they're always there, and mm-hmm. there's usually some sticky ones. It wasn't much after that one. It was only a year or two into my first term, when I'm sure most of your listeners would have heard of the Ruth Neslin murder and trial, and that happened when I'd only just been in office a very short time, and the arraignment over in the courthouse, the old courthouse in Friday Harbor, the arraignment took place, and I was there, and there were so many people in the room that the floor not just sagged, but it started moving up and down, in there, and to the point where the fire marshal came in, evacuated it, and then did some calculations for a few days and came to the county commission and said, this building is in terrible shape, doesn't meet any codes or even close to the codes, and it needs to be condemned.
The San Juan County Courthouse.
The San Juan County Courthouse has to be condemned. And we studied it with him and with Gene Knapp, our legal advisor, or the prosecuting attorney, and what we could do. And there was just no way out of it. We had to condemn the courthouse, which meant that we all had to move out. Everybody that was in the courthouse had to move out, which we had to go find other locations for the offices. And then became the huge controversial issue of, well, should you renovate the old courthouse or should you tear it down? And it was extremely controversial. There were people on all sides with actually very good reasons to do either one. Mm-hmm. On the side of renovating it, it was, even though it was a not a very attractive building, utilitarian for sure, it still was the oldest public building in the county, and that utilitarian component of reflected the values of the citizens of when it was built. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it was going to cost way, way more to renovate it than it would be to just tear the old thing down, build something new that would serve a modern era, mm-hmm. which we're at. And it's a lot more complicated than that, but those were kind of the themes. Mm-hmm. And it became so complicated. We couldn't make a decision. We'd hear and vacillate, frankly. Couldn't, because it was a very difficult
decision.
And that
decision. Was the three of you, the three commissioners.
The three county commissioners.
Yeah, right.
Then we finally threw our hands up in the air and said, okay, we can't make a decision on this. We'll let the people make a decision. And we put it out to an advisory vote of the people. That's not something people usually vote on, but you can put an advisory ballot out there. And we thought, okay, we'll let them decide what's best for it. And wouldn't you know it, that the result came back virtually 50-50. So we hadn't helped ourselves at all. We still had the difficult task. And I should mention, since this is a Lopez radio, that I was hearing no end from a lot of people, including Nancy McCoy, who was a leading advocate of renovating that building and brought us a lot of facts and figures that ultimately helped me make a decision to proceed with renovation. It also helped that we found a historic architect that had done a lot of work down in Seattle, in the old districts in Seattle. And he came up with a plan that we could do it with, that didn't cost us a fortune like we'd been told by the high end engineers, and that helped. And we ended up renovating the building, and it was the right decision. There's no question in my mind that was the right thing to do, and it's still. It's been a couple of little earthquakes. I always pay attention. It's still standing.
Oh my gosh.
So that was, those are a couple of the controversial things that happened. I appreciated my opportunities to help with the Lopez Community Center, getting some money from the county to help them. Lynn Waller was a strong advocate for that. Mm-hmm. And I was able to help in a small way. I helped in some small ways on getting Morgantown. Help them out getting started. Sandy Bishop, that when Lopez Community Land Trust first started it, for I never did figure it out, but it was very, it seemed to be very controversial, and it was a real difficult time, and finally really needed a show place, something to show that this is a good thing for the community. And
affordable housing was not popular.
It was not popular. And,
it wasn't popular.
No.
Because everybody recognized it was needed, but nobody wanted to do anything about it. It's kind of the same as it is
now. For some reason, some people felt that those folks don't work, which of course was not true at all. But they don't pay taxes and they just want to receive.
Okay.
That was the attitude, against it. But
So Sandy Bishop was spearheading that back then at the very first.
The very first one.
Morgantown.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And you were able to help get some funding through to support that effort.
Yeah, I was just able to smooth the way. So I just did some small things. But, those things stick in your mind as little things that you're able to do to help the community. And I think that's a big part of being a county commissioner is helping your local community get done what's a priority in that community.
Well, right. Yeah, and now we have three community land trust projects.
Well, four.
Four completed.
Yeah,
four completed.
The last new one being Common Ground.
Common Ground just opened last year.
Yeah.
So there's four now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then there was Shark Reef. What now? Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, yes, I can. I think, you know, my niche kind of as a county commissioner, I think, came in recognizing the need for protecting open spaces and not just by buying them, but also having planning tools that would manage growth in the future. So we have a ultimately a community that we want. And that's really difficult to do, and we'll probably never achieve it, but you always work that way. And so I was a strong advocate of long-range planning, and still am. And but I got to work on some things that were really quite interesting. The Commissioner of Public Lands at the time wanted to clear-cut Shark Reef. Actually clear-cut it.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we got a new Commissioner of Public Lands, which is Brian Boyle, and many people, Asha Leela, Cynthia Dilling, a whole lot of people. I shouldn't even start naming because there's a lot of people, but started working to try to work on Shark Reef, and we were able to. He personally came up and preserved that.
Okay.
by providing a long-term lease to take care of that. And that was a really big deal at the time, and it kind of energized me into working on other properties. And we had a number of opportunities working. The Department of Natural Resources had properties at Lopez Hill and Odland South and Chadwick Hill and the Watmau Bay area that some were slated for. Well, actually, all of those were slated for some kind of logging, and we initiated a long planning process that was able to keep them from being logged on the near term, but didn't do much for the long term, and so we decided to try to make a partnership, and I was fortunate. In my position, I was able to, I always call it, I didn't do that much except I kind of brokered the deal. I brought the parties together at one time, a famous lunch down in Seattle where about the key person from the Bureau of Land Management with the key person in the Department of Natural Resources. And I got them together at lunch and they started talking and got energized themselves and started doing things on napkins. Mm. And I just sat back and just sat there the whole lunch. I didn't contribute much at all, except I kind of brought them together. And ultimately, through a whole lot of hard work by citizens of Lopez, we're able to help and get the land transferred, the DNR property transferred to the Bureau of Land Management. That was important, and I felt that was something that I really enjoyed doing and that I was pretty good at.
Are those lands protected now from clear cutting?
Yes. Yeah. There would not be any clear cutting on those. Now Lopez Hill and Odland South, which hasn't actually culminated yet, but it will. It's a done deal, basically, are properties that are under lease. So 50-year lease.
Okay.
And so what happens in 50 years if we can't get the money together to buy the underlying deed to them is we don't know.
Okay.
So that is in the future. Something could happen. And so that's why it's important to remember that we need to take care of business as fast as we can and get them permanently protected.
Okay.
And so there's an ongoing effort to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're... Certainly for the near term, they're in good shape.
Yeah.
Is this all connected with the fact that we have this strange law that says that schools have to be getting money from cutting of the forests, which was, you know, an old law from the 19th century?
Hmm.
But does it all still exist, or has that
it stems from that the trust lands, DNR is required to make income for schools off their trust lands, and they were not able to generate income off of most of their properties in San Juan County, and when they did try to do some logging, not only is it expensive because of the transportation issue, right. There was so much opposition from the citizens that had come to just love those public lands that it was really difficult. So they made a decision a number of years ago now to divest themselves of all the properties in San Juan County.
Okay.
And what we've been doing since then, a number of us have been working to try to make sure that when it is divested, that it's not sold for development purposes. And so we have Lopez Hill and Odland South, for instance, going to the county. The Chadwick Hill went to the Bureau of Land Management. Mitchell Hill over on San Juan Island is now right in the process. That's not quite a done deal, but it looks very positive that's going to go to the National Park Service. So keeping these lands in public instead of being developed, that's our goal.
Right, and not always easy.
No.
I bet. I mean, hard.
Well, the year that Watmau was saved and Turtleback was saved all at the same year, that was really amazing.
Fell swoop, yeah.
Because that meant, and of course, as time goes on, it always means more money than you ever thought possible, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. for the land.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Tom, can you talk to us about the land bank?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Land bank is something that a lot of us worked on. I personally feel very proud to have been one of the leaders in getting that started, and I actually serve on the Land Bank Commission now. But back then, nobody had ever heard of a land bank, to my knowledge, other than Peter Fisher from Orcas Island, who's I call a visionary on a number of issues, but in terms of open space, he had this vision of creating a land bank, patterned off a couple of land banks back in on the East Coast. There was nothing west of the Mississippi.
Hmm.
There were a few on the East Coast, and I used to joke. I like Peter, but I used to say he was pestering me all the time as I was county commissioner to get more involved in this land bank thing. And I learned from Peter, and I liked the idea, but, you know, there's a lot of pressing other business, and I hadn't fully got hold of it until I was invited to speak at an international conference on islands, which was a fascinating conference because islands have very similar issues wherever they are. And this was an international, this is around the world. You know, whether it's transportation, which is a big one, or tourism, or development, open space, a lot of different issues. They're very common. It's a fascinating conference, but it took place on Martha's Vineyard. And that's where the conference took place, which happened to be one of the counties that had a land bank. So I went actually a day in advance of the conference and met with the director of the land bank to learn more about it, and it just bowled me over. It was such a success story that I really got the bug to try to do something out here. And when I came back, I like my wife used to say from time to time, she'd say you were possessed. that I just really wanted to try to do whatever I could to make this happen. And like I said, working with a lot of other people. And I decided the best thing to do would be to start getting together with county leaders, leaders throughout the county from the various islands. And I organized these Saturday morning breakfasts in Friday Harbor. And we'd do them every couple of weeks for a period of time, trying to bring together a common vision for what a land bank would look like. And one of the early ideas, actually from Peter and others, was it should be both open space, preserving open space, and it should be for affordable housing. But in terms of working it out with all the county leaders, more than not felt that the having it dual purpose could bring it down, that you better focus on one thing and just hope that you can make that satisfactory. Worked a lot with realtors because what we envisioned as the funding tool was a real estate excise tax. So realtors are very concerned about taxes when real estate is exchanged, and yet that was by far the way to go for sure. And some people advocated for 2%. For those of you that understand the land bank, ultimately the compromise, this is just at these breakfasts, was 1%. And the realtors, I invited a lot of realtors. It was almost half realtors. And they weren't new realtors. They were realtors that had been around for some time. People like Sam Buck Sr. on San Juan, Wally Gudgel on Orcas. Diane Presenda attended some of those, as did Jim Budlong from Lopez. I think Annie Albritton maybe came to one. People that really feel strongly about their community. They're not just out to sell some real estate, but they feel strongly about their community.
Deep investment.
Yeah, and the concept was not difficult for them to embrace. They embraced the concept of preserving open spaces, natural vistas, environmentally sensitive areas, low passive type park areas, but we had to work so we had all could agree, and that's where this 1% came about. The realtors insisted on having the tax on the buyer and not the seller, which actually ended up being the biggest stumbling block in the state legislation. So with this vision, this is, and tell me if I'm going on in too much depth with this, because I could go on and on, but
you're passionate about this.
Yeah. when the first step before the county could do anything like that is to get the state to enable it. It was illegal. Oh. You couldn't create a San Juan County land bank in San Juan County because it required state enabling legislation that allowed a county to levy a tax. And so we had to get the state to do enabling legislation. And the idea is that we would, in 1990, we would go down, try to get a bill written and sponsored, and get a committee hearing to educate the legislature. And then the next year, or even the third year, it was a 2 or 3 year program, try to get the bill passed. But it wasn't the intention to get it passed in the first year. We didn't think that was even possible, since it was such a new concept entirely on the West Coast of the United States, and certainly in Washington State. And that's the funny part of the story. These things, I mean, they just happen sometimes, is that we're able to go down and get sponsorship by, which was helpful, our own 40th District Senator, Pat McMullen, who was very powerful in the Senate, but more powerful than Pat McMullen was Senator Dan McDonald, who was very conservative Republican. He's got property and a house on Lopez Island. I knew him personally, and figured that was going to be a real problem, is to get that through the Republican Senate, and he talked to him and. In actually the very first meeting, he just kind of, yeah, that's a good idea. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? And it turns out that Dan grew up in Orange County and saw how that county, the beautiful open spaces had all been destroyed. And even though he's fiscally very conservative and is well known as being that, he had a passion for open space, which not too many people knew about.
Okay.
I didn't know about it until then. What happened is this whole thing got caught up in gubernatorial politics, in that Dan wanted to run for governor the next time around. The speaker, and Dan was the Senate Majority Leader, most powerful person in the Senate. His counterpart was the Speaker of the House, which is the most powerful person in the House, who also wanted to run for governor.
Oh,
and he was a Democrat, Joe King.
Okay.
And this whole thing got caught up in that Dan sponsored this bill, and Joe King thought, well, this will never go anywhere. He'll pull the plug on this before it ever gets real, but I'm going to rub his nose in it in the meantime. Uh-huh. And Dan says, okay, whatever. He can do whatever he wants. And Joe never believed that this would happen, because the law, in order to pass a law enabling San Juan County to do it, you have to do it for the whole state.
Okay.
And it would, and if the whole state passed it, it would be millions and millions and millions of dollars in taxes. But it had to be voted on by every county. That was part of the bill we wrote. And Dan thought that was okay. And Joe never thought it. Well, the long and the short of it is, this is the funny part. Well, that's already, I think, pretty interesting part of the story. But really, the most interesting part is, when Joe expected Dan to blink, they passed it in the House, I believe, first, and it was supposed to pass the Senate. Dan didn't blink. And he got his caucus to pass it. And so it passed the legislature. Nobody expected it. It had actually passed just like that. And it was on a Thursday. And I was down there, and I didn't know what to do. It was like a Thursday night. And all of a sudden, the Republicans, a lot of the Republicans were going ballistic at their own leader for allowing this to get passed, because they thought they would be hurt politically on it. And they started looking at ways that they could... through a parliamentary procedure, get it pulled back in, which there are some, I don't know how they are, but there's anything, they always say whatever they want to do, they can do. So the only thing that we could do is get this, get the governor to sign it and make it law, since the legislature had passed it. So I made some phone calls and got the head staff person aware that the legislature was likely going to pull this back in and kill the bill. And I did come home that night, and I went back on Saturday. Booth Gardner was the governor at the time. Mm-hmm. He called me into his office, and I said, you know, if you could sign this bill, that'd be really great. And he asked me some questions about the bill, because he had never heard about it, because he hadn't thought it was going to pass. Now, that's not true. He had heard about it in the last day, because he was considering signing it, so he had his staff people research it. But until the day before, he didn't even know it existed.
Okay.
And so he comes in, and his staff person, so he says, do you think this is good? I said, well, of course I think it's good. And he looks to his staff person, who's really, he wasn't looking to me. He was looking to his staff person to say, you know, it sounds kind of good. What do you think? He said, guy says, sign it. He signed it on a Saturday morning.
Oh.
And so it got signed. And it was a done deal. And we had a land bank, the enabling legislation, to pass it in the 1990 legislature, the first go-around. Came back, and six counties put it on the ballot that fall. Certainly San Juan County, because we had designed it. Six other counties, including King County, the most populous county. It failed miserably in all the other counties, unfortunately, but it passed overwhelmingly in San Juan County. Mm. And we now have a San Juan County land bank, and have now for 20 years, that is protecting open spaces. And for those, I mean, because Ollie, you were mentioning that it gets confused with the San Juan Preservation mm-hmm. Trust, because we do a lot of the same things. And there's people that still don't understand it. We have a number of preserves here. We've got the Fisherman Bay Spit, the Tombolo, the Weeks Wetland, the Hummel Lake Preserve, the Upright Head Preserve. These are all owned by the land bank and open to the public for their use and enjoyment. Plus, there's a lot of conservation easements where the land bank doesn't own it and there's not public participation, but farmland is preserved, scenic vistas are preserved, and of course, as you mentioned, Ollie, a few minutes ago, the biggest thing that happened, that the land bank was a partner in, it didn't do it by itself. San Juan Preservation took a strong leadership role, but we did use $10 million of the land bank money, was Turtleback Mountain on Orcas, which is the gem of the San Juans. It's just the most wonderful thing. So, yes, I'm passionate about the land bank. It's something that I feel proud that I at least had a part in making that happen, and it was very fun, and thank you for asking me.
Wonderful story.
It's kind of funny how it happened. A lot of people don't know the ins and outs of
right.
what, you know, it was exciting.
Yeah. Well, it was one of the things that it appealed to me when I came to Lopez Island, was to realize that so much, this high percentage of gorgeous vista and land was actually public land. And mm-hmm. up until this very moment, I didn't know exactly the mechanism that made all that come to pass.
So there is a 1%, every time property is sold, there's a 1% real estate excise tax, and It doesn't seem to be a big burden.
It's so little, really, and it just wants so.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of our hour. Actually, we're about a minute over the hour.
Oh, okay.
So I'm wondering, Allie, if we can't extend our hour by a few minutes and hear one last story about Fred Ellis. Do you think we can do that?
I think we should.
If it's okay.
Let's do that.
Right before, I just got off the ferry before this conversation, I'd been over to the memorial service for Fred Ellis, and it was wonderful. There was
Fred Ellis Sr.
Fred Ellis Sr., yes, Fred Ellis Sr. He's 94 years old.
Uh-huh.
Did so much for San Juan County. And the little story, because it is pretty humorous, that I want to tell is that I was an incumbent county commissioner in 1990, and Fred chose to challenge me. And I was a little surprised, because we were pretty close. But nevertheless, that's what happened. And well into the, it was probably two-thirds of the way through the campaign, there was a debate on Shaw Island that night. And Fred and Marilyn very graciously invited me to dinner. Okay. And so I went over to their house, had a wonderful dinner, and while we're sitting there having a cup of coffee before we go out to debate each other, Fred says to me, he says, well, you know, Tom, I don't really expect to beat you in this election. And and I'm kind of exasperated, and I said, well, then why are we having this dance if you don't expect to beat me? And he got out a piece of paper. I'll never forget it. He got out a piece of paper and drew what he was explaining. He says, well, everybody knows that your politics are right down the middle. You're neither right nor left. You're right down the middle. That's your reputation. And everybody knows that my reputation is way over here on the left. And I said, well, yes, that's true, Fred. Everybody does know that. And he says, well, the way I figure it is if through this election process, if I can get you to meet me halfway to my side, it will have been well worth the exercise. I don't know if I believed that he didn't want to win the election, but but I believed what he said too, and it was a great story, and it was a very interesting. I'll never forget, because in my opinion, he was a great person, and he showed that. My last comment, I guess, is he showed that in a really classy way when I did go on to win the election, and the next morning he had a friend deliver a very expensive bottle of Dom Perignon champagne to our house, and I later found out it was a $120 bottle of champagne a concession gift.
Oh.
That's pretty classy, and it was fun to tell that story today over on the ferry when a bunch of us from Lopez went over to his memorial service. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tom. This was beautiful. I feel very fortunate to have lived through the years that you were commissioner, so that some of the stories brought back a lot for me. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. This is another edition of Once Upon an Island.
This show was pre-recorded on March 27th, 2010, on Lopez Island. All views offered here today are those of the program hosts and our guests. Thank you for listening.